From NPR News, this is live special coverage of President Obama's State of the Union Address, along with the Republican response from Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State. I'm Robert Siegel, and in just a moment, President Barack Obama will make his way through the House chamber. His fifth official State of the Union Address is expected to include a few key themes, among them income inequality and social mobility, also immigration and education. Two words that we're likely to hear a lot of tonight, middle class. The president has been trying for weeks to shift the conversation away from talk of the healthcare website and NSA spying and towards ideas to help people out of poverty and to grow the middle class. I'm joined here by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson and NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. And first, Mara, your thoughts. What do you expect from the president tonight, both in message and in tone?
Well, I expect a vigorous, optimistic speech, which is the way the White House is billing it. I think the president will push back against this notion that nothing can get done this year. I think he'll offer an agenda that's going to sound pretty familiar because a lot of the items on it will be things he wanted to get done last year, like immigration reform, raising the minimum wage, but he didn't, so he's trying again. And I also think he's going to have a lot of examples of ways that he can chip away at these problems with executive action, even if Congress is not going to pass his initiatives. He's going to raise the minimum wage for new federal contracts, federal workers, to $10.10 an hour. That's something he can do even without Congress passing the minimum wage.
The applause that we're hearing, by the way, from the House chamber is in response to First Lady Michelle Obama taking her place in the gallery overlooking the House floor. And momentarily, we expect the sergeant-at-arms to announce that the president with the escort committee of... Oh, here
Mr.
we are.
Mr. Speaker, the president's cabinet.
This is the cabinet first. And, they'll be followed eventually by the president himself. We're deep into the president's time in the White House, Mara. I mean, this is all... He knows the drill already. He's done this several times. How do you think that makes the challenge different for a president to give a State of the Union?
Well, I think that it makes the challenge different because he's in his sixth year. He knows that the public is in a sour mood. He knows that his own approval ratings have slumped from the high 50s a year ago to the low 40s today. He knows his party is facing a very difficult reelection, and he knows he had a really rocky year last year, and he's been hurt by the botched rollout of Obamacare. He has a lot of work to do. He's got to get his approval rating up if he's going to help Democrats next year. And the speech is a big opportunity for him to reframe the debate and refocus the debate. He's the only one who gets an opportunity like this, and I think he's going to make the most of it tonight.
Tamara, you cover the White House.
Yes.
Do they regard this as a big opportunity for a reset of sorts?
They certainly see this as an opportunity to get some eyeballs and to defend some of the president's policies. Certainly, this is a very large stage, so we can expect to hear the president talk about the Affordable Care Act and defend the Affordable Care Act and encourage people to sign up, for instance, because so many people are watching. Of course, not as many people are watching as have watched in the past. And so, interestingly, the White House will be doing sort of a digital simulcast where it's like pop-up video on MT or on VH1. Mm-hmm. They'll be tweeting out thought bubbles and pictures and other things, trying to take this speech viral in a way.
They're trying to turn the State of the Union into true 21st century entertainment, you're saying,
or infotainment,
public affairs.
Possibly.
Infotainment. this will be followed, as I said, by the message that Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers will give on behalf of the Republicans. The contrast between the State of the Union, this high ceremony that we observe every year, and then some opposition politician sitting in usually a very quiet room speaking with no audience present, nobody to rise in applause up and down, it's always quite a contrast.
It is indeed, and it has certainly presented a challenge at many times for the people that deliver this response to get the tone right. I think that it's certainly interesting that Republicans and deliberate that Republicans have chosen the highest ranking Republican woman in Congress to deliver the response. And they've been tweeting pictures all week of her with her three young children and other images really to push the idea that Republicans are a party for women and that it's a family message.
which has been a problem for them. They've suffered at the bottom end of a losing end of a gender gap over the years.
To the point where they've had training with Republican members of Congress about how to talk to women and how to talk about women's issues, and yet they keep stepping into minefields.
What's happening right now in the House chamber is that the president's cabinet, the members of the cabinet, are making their way down the aisle, and as they do so, they shake hands with members who are greeting them. Pretty soon we expect to hear the president himself announced, and then he, of course, will be greeted by many members as he makes his way down the aisle into the podium. The House chamber, of course, accommodates more people routinely than the Senate chamber. It is where this happens every year. It's packed, because you've got the House of Representatives, you've got the senators, you have the galleries full of their guests, we have members of the Supreme Court, the Diplomatic Corps, the Joint Chiefs, and it's quite a packed house.
Indeed, and cabinet members who are walking in right now. One thing that if folks were watching this on television, they would see, or if they're in the chamber, they would see, is that a number of Democrats actually have teal-colored ribbons on their jackets and
teal
suits.
Teal-colored?
Teal, well, a blue.
Uh-huh. Okay, no, I accept it.
It's sort of a teal, and the reason that they have those ribbons is they're trying to draw attention to the long-term unemployed. Unemployment benefits have still not been renewed. This is sort of an outstanding issue left over from last year, and Democrats are trying to renew the push using this large audience here.
Well, looking over the scene at the House of Representatives is NPR congressional correspondent Elsa Chang, who can see it all. How does it look to you, Elsa?
The scene is pretty packed here. The guests mostly have arrived. We're now waiting for the president to arrive. There's some people sitting unexpectedly near some neighbors. We have Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, sandwiched between John McCain of Arizona and Marco Rubio of Florida, right in front of Ted Cruz. We also see Kelly Adolf of New Hampshire sitting right next to Cory Booker of New Jersey, the new Senate Democrat.
So this is the result of a conscious effort of the past couple of years to have some buddy seating in the state of the
Union. That's right. As Tam was just saying, there was a push to try to extend long-term unemployment benefits right before the January recess, but that collapsed in the Senate. There's been a great deal of discord in that body, so it's kind of nice to see some unexpected neighbors sitting next to each other tonight.
Yeah, typically it used to be that the Republicans would sit on one side of the chamber, Democrats on the other, whenever a line was given that warranted some applause, the president's party would rise up and applaud him, and you could see the other half of the hall seated, unless it was something that was said about our servicemen and women or something of that sort that was extremely bipartisan. But nowadays, the fashion is to find a friend of the other party and sit with him or her as a gesture of Americanness, I guess.
That's right. There was a great deal of bipartisan excitement. One of the guests here, Willie Robertson, the star of Duck Dynasty, I'm sitting actually just around the corner from him. He's been getting actually a lot of attention from lawmakers tonight, trying to grab shots with him. One of the guests who
those
did
are
receive
picture shots, you say?
Right, yeah. Right. A bunch of picture shots. For listeners who may not know, his father was temporarily suspended from Duck Dynasty for having said some anti-gay and racist remarks. But one guest that did receive a standing ovation was Carlos Arredondo. He's one of the survivors of the Boston Marathon bombing. When he came in, most of the chamber rose and applauded while he was sitting down.
We believe that the president right now is just outside the door of the House chamber. And in a moment, we expect to hear the announcement that he is awaiting an invitation to enter. The House Speaker, John Boehner, sent a traditional committee of members of the House to invite the president to bring him over to the chamber. That's been done, and now we're just waiting for the next bang on the door, which I suspect we'll hear very soon. President, typically, Mara, I'm trying to think back to recent State of the Union addresses. Speeches tend to run about an hour, past 10 p.m. Eastern, usually. Here we are.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
And with that announcement, the president is about to enter. He's in the chamber right now and being mobbed by well-wishers, members of the House and Senate, who are greeting him. It should take him a couple of minutes to make it up to the front of the chamber, and when he does, he'll begin his speech. Usually, this takes, Mara, I was saying, about 45 minutes or so to an hour of speaking?
45 minutes to an hour. A lot of applause. Sometimes you see that seesaw applause effect mm-hmm. with the Republicans sitting on their hands and Democrats jumping up to applaud. But what will be interesting in this speech, of course, is to see how much partisan red meat is in it for Democrats. And what issues he chooses to offer a bipartisan olive branch on. I expect that on immigration, he'll do that. He wants to preserve the ability to get something done this year, doesn't want to antagonize John Boehner or make his job any harder. So I think that he's going to be very conciliatory on immigration. On other issues like minimum wage, issues that are good populist rallying cries for Democrats, I think his tone might be a little sharper.
Yeah. We should explain that when the president delivers the State of the Union, sitting just behind him are the Speaker of the House, who presides over the House of Representatives, and the Vice President of the United States, because he is the presiding officer of the United States Senate. This is a ceremony of state, I suppose, and as a result, the president, as he's now entering the House chamber, is joined by Senator Harry Reid is in that group, the majority leader, the leader of the Senate Democrats, but also Eric Cantor, the majority leader, the leader of the House Republicans, second, of course, to John Boehner. And they're making their way up to the front of the hall. Elsa, is he almost there?
He is about two-thirds of the way there. There's kisses and hugs for every row.
I think this is a reasonably bipartisan moment every year when the president is received. Judging from this, Mara, we would think that, you know, these are people who get along awfully well and legislate routinely.
Yes, that's what it looks like. Everybody's very convivial and happy. And don't forget, there's a lot to be gained by being bipartisan. We know from polls that voters like it when the two parties work together. They just haven't done that very much in the last couple of years.
President greeting his own cabinet, which is seated near the front of the chamber. Among them, former member of the U.S. Senate, John Kerry, now his Secretary of State. We expect the president to have some remarks about issues of foreign policy, why he does not oppose additional sanctions against Iran at this moment, what he'll say about U.S. forces in Afghanistan and the need for a bilateral security agreement with the Afghan government. But generally, we expect this to be a speech about domestic issues, as it usually is. And the theme of economic inequality has become a major talking point in Washington these days, Tamara. I mean, it used to be there was some argument about, really, is there inequality? That seems to be agreed now there is.
Yeah, and I think the White House would argue that the president's eye has always been on the economy, but it hasn't always led the news or sort of dominated the discourse. And I think that once again with this speech, he's going to try to renew the focus and put it on the economy again.
President Barack Obama is now at the podium in front of the chamber of the House of Representatives and shaking hands with the people just below the podium. And you can hear him now at the microphone. Here he is.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
That, of course, Speaker John Boehner, the President having just submitted a written copy of his remarks to the Speaker and to Vice President Biden. And now we expect his State of the Union address to begin.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, my fellow Americans. Today in America,
a teacher spent extra time with a student who needed it and did her part to lift America's graduation rate to its highest levels in more than three decades. An entrepreneur flipped on the lights in her tech startup and did her part to add to the more than 8 million new jobs our businesses have created over the past 4 years. An auto worker fine-tuned some of the best, most fuel-efficient cars in the world and did his part to help America wean itself off foreign oil. A farmer prepared for the spring after the strongest five-year stretch of farm exports in our history. A rural doctor gave a young child the first prescription to treat asthma that his mother could afford. A man took the bus home from the graveyard shift, bone-tired, but dreaming big dreams for his son. And in tight-knit communities all across America, fathers and mothers will tuck in their kids, put an arm around their spouse, remember fallen comrades, and give thanks for being home from a war that, after 12 long years, is finally coming to an end. Tonight, this chamber speaks with one voice to the people we represent. It is you, our citizens, who make the state of our union strong. And here are the results of your efforts. The lowest unemployment rate in over 5 years, a rebounding housing market, a manufacturing sector that's adding jobs for the first time since the 1990s. More oil produced at home than we buy from the rest of the world. The first time that's happened in nearly 20 years. Our deficits cut by more than half. And for the first time in over a decade, business leaders around the world have declared that China is no longer the world's number one place to invest. America is. That's why I believe this can be a breakthrough year for America. After 5 years of grit and determined effort, the United States is better positioned for the 21st century than any other nation on earth. The question for everyone in this chamber, running through every decision we make this year, is whether we are going to help or hinder this progress. For several years now, this town has been consumed by a rancorous argument over the proper size of the federal government. It's an important debate, one that dates back to our very founding. But when that debate prevents us from carrying out even the most basic functions of our democracy, when our differences shut down government or threaten the full faith and credit of the United States, then we are not doing right by the American people. Now, as president, I'm committed to making Washington work better and rebuilding the trust of the people who sent us here. And I believe most of you are, too. Last month, thanks to the work of Democrats and Republicans, Congress finally produced a budget that undoes some of last year's severe cuts to priorities like education. Nobody got everything they wanted, and we can still do more to invest in this country's future, while bringing down our deficit in a balanced way. But the budget compromise should leave us freer to focus on creating new jobs, not creating new crises. And in the coming months, let's see where else we can make progress together. Let's make this a year of action. That's what most Americans want. For all of us in this chamber to focus on their lives, their hopes, their aspirations. And what I believe unites the people of this nation, regardless of race or region or party, young or old, rich or poor, is the simple, profound belief in opportunity for all. The notion that if you work hard and take responsibility, you can get ahead in America. Now, let's face it, that belief has suffered some serious blows. Over more than three decades, even before the Great Recession hit, massive shifts in technology and global competition had eliminated a lot of good middle-class jobs and weakened the economic foundations that families depend on. Today, after 4 years of economic growth, corporate profits and stock prices have rarely been higher, and those at the top have never done better. But average wages have barely budged. Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled. The cold hard fact is that even in the midst of recovery, too many Americans are working more than ever just to get by, let alone to get ahead. And too many still aren't working at all. So our job is to reverse these trends. It won't happen right away, and we won't agree on everything. But what I offer tonight is a set of concrete, practical proposals to speed up growth, strengthen the middle class, and build new ladders of opportunity into the middle class. Some require congressional action, and I am eager to work with all of you. But America does not stand still, and neither will I. So wherever and whenever I can take steps without legislation to expand opportunity for more American families, that's what I'm going to do. As usual, our First Lady sets a good example. Michelle's Let's Move partnership with schools, businesses, local leaders has helped bring down childhood obesity rates for the first time in 30 years. And that's an achievement that will improve lives and reduce health care costs for decades to come. The Joining Forces Alliance that Michelle and Jill Biden launched has already encouraged employers to hire or train nearly 400,000 veterans and military spouses. Taking a page from that playbook, the White House just organized a College Opportunity Summit, where already 150 universities, businesses, nonprofits have made concrete commitments to reduce inequality in access to higher education and to help every hardworking kid go to college and succeed when they get to campus. And across the country, we're partnering with mayors, governors, and state legislatures on issues from homelessness to marriage equality. The point is, there are millions of Americans outside of Washington who are tired of stale political arguments and are moving this country forward. They believe, and I believe, that here in America, our success should depend not on accident of birth, but the strength of our work ethic and the scope of our dreams. That's what drew our forebears here. That's how the daughter of a factory worker is CEO of America's largest automaker. How the son of a barkeep is Speaker of the House.
Even Vice President Biden just rose to applaud Speaker of the House, John Boehner.
The son of a single mom can be president of the greatest nation on earth. Now,
this is President Obama's State of the Union address from NPR.
Opportunity is who we are. And the defining project of our generation must be to restore that promise. We know where to start. The best measure of opportunity is access to a good job. With the economy picking up speed, companies say they intend to hire more people this year. And over half of big manufacturers say they're thinking of insourcing jobs from abroad. So let's make that decision easier for more companies. Both Democrats and Republicans have argued that our tax code is riddled with wasteful, complicated loopholes that punish businesses investing here and reward companies that keep profits abroad. Let's flip that equation. Let's work together to close those loopholes and those incentives to ship jobs overseas and lower tax rates for businesses that create jobs right here at home. Moreover, we can take the money we save from this transition to tax reform to create jobs, rebuilding our roads, upgrading our ports, unclogging our commutes. Because in today's global economy, first-class jobs gravitate to first-class infrastructure. We'll need Congress to protect more than 3 million jobs by finishing transportation and waterways bills this summer. That can happen. But I'll act on my own to slash bureaucracy and streamline the permitting process for key projects so we can get more construction workers on the job as fast as possible. We also have the chance right now to beat other countries in the race for the next wave of high-tech manufacturing jobs. And my administration's launched two hubs for high-tech manufacturing in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Youngstown, Ohio, where we've connected businesses to research universities that can help America lead the world in advanced technologies. Tonight, I'm announcing we'll launch six more this year. Bipartisan bills in both houses could double the number of these hubs and the jobs they create. So get those bills to my desk. Put more Americans back to work. Let's do more to help the entrepreneurs and small business owners who create most new jobs in America. Over the past 5 years, my administration has made more loans to small business owners than any other. And when 98% of our exporters are small businesses, new trade partnerships with Europe and the Asia Pacific will help them create even more jobs. We need to work together on tools like Bipartisan Trade Promotion Authority to protect our workers, protect our environment, and open new markets to new goods stamped Made in the USA. Listen, China and Europe aren't standing on the sidelines. Neither should we. We know that the nation that goes all in on innovation today will own the global economy tomorrow. This is an edge America cannot surrender. Federally funded research helped lead to the ideas and inventions behind Google and smartphones, and that's why Congress should undo the damage done by last year's cuts to basic research so we can unleash the next great American discovery. There are entire industries to be built based on vaccines that stay ahead of drug-resistant bacteria or paper-thin material that's stronger than steel. And let's pass a patent reform bill that allows our businesses to stay focused on innovation, not costly and needless litigation. Now, one of the biggest factors in bringing more jobs back is our commitment to American energy. The all-the-above energy strategy I announced a few years ago is working, and today America is closer to energy independence than we have been in decades. One of the reasons why is natural gas. If extracted safely, it's the bridge fuel that can power our economy with less of the carbon pollution that causes climate change. Businesses plan to invest almost $100 billion in new factories that use natural gas. I'll cut red tape to help states get those factories built and put folks to work. And this Congress can help by putting people to work building fueling stations that shift more cars and trucks from foreign oil to American natural gas. Meanwhile, my administration will keep working with the industry to sustain production and jobs growth while strengthening protection of our air, our water, our communities. And while we're at it, I'll use my authority to protect more of our pristine federal lands for future generations. Well, it's not just oil and natural gas production that's booming. We're becoming a global leader in solar, too. Every 4 minutes, another American home or business goes solar. Every panel pounded into place by a worker whose job cannot be outsourced. Let's continue that progress with a smarter tax policy that stops giving $4 billion a year to fossil fuel industries that don't need it so we can invest more in fuels of the future that do. And even as we've increased energy production, we've partnered with businesses, builders, and local communities to reduce the energy we consume. When we rescued our automakers, for example, we worked with them to set higher fuel efficiency standards for our cars. In the coming months, I'll build on that success by setting new standards for our trucks so we can keep driving down oil imports and what we pay at the pump. And taken together, our energy policy is creating jobs and leading to a cleaner, safer planet. Over the past 8 years, the United States has reduced our total carbon pollution more than any other nation on Earth. But we have to act with more urgency, because a changing climate is already harming Western communities struggling with drought and coastal cities dealing with floods. That's why I directed my administration to work with states, utilities, and others to set new standards on the amount of carbon pollution our power plants are allowed to dump into the air. The shift to a cleaner energy economy won't happen overnight, and it will require some tough choices along the way. But the debate is settled. Climate change is a fact. And when our children's children look us in the eye and ask if we did all we could to leave them a safer, more stable world with new sources of energy, I want us to be able to say, yes, we did. Finally, if we're serious about economic growth, it is time to heed the call of business leaders, labor leaders, faith leaders, law enforcement, and fix our broken immigration system. Yeah. Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have acted, and I know that members of both parties in the House want to do the same. Independent economists say immigration reform will grow our economy and shrink our deficits by almost $1 trillion in the next two decades. And for good reason. When people come here to fulfill their dreams, to study, invent, contribute to our culture, they make our country a more attractive place for businesses to locate and create jobs for everybody. So let's get immigration reform done this year. Let's get it done. It's time. The ideas I've outlined so far can speed up growth and create more jobs. But in this rapidly changing economy, we have to make sure that every American has the skills to fill those jobs. The good news is we know how to do it. 2 years ago, as the auto industry came roaring back, Andra Rush opened up a manufacturing firm in Detroit. She knew that Ford needed parts for the best-selling truck in America, and she knew how to make those parts. She just needed the workforce. So she dialed up what we call an American Job Center, places where folks can walk in to get the help or training they need to find a new job or a better job. She was flooded with new workers. And today, Detroit Manufacturing Systems has more than 700 employees. Now, what Andra and her employees experienced is how it should be for every employer and every job seeker. So tonight, I've asked Vice President Biden to lead an across-the-board reform of America's training programs to make sure they have one mission: train Americans with the skills employers need and match them to good jobs that need to be filled right now. That means more on-the-job training and more apprenticeships that set a young worker on an upward trajectory for life. It means connecting companies to community colleges that can help design training to fill their specific needs. And if Congress wants to help, you can concentrate funding on proven programs that connect more ready-to-work Americans with ready-to-be-filled jobs. I'm also convinced we can help Americans return to the workforce faster by reforming unemployment insurance so that it's more effective in today's economy. But first, this Congress needs to restore the unemployment insurance you just let expire for 1.6 million people.
This is President Obama's State of the Union message from NPR News. Big Democratic applause here for extending unemployment benefits that the Congress let expire.
Let me tell you why. Misty DeMars is a mother of two young boys. She'd been steadily employed since she was a teenager, put herself through college. She'd never collected unemployment benefits, but she'd been paying taxes. In May, she and her husband used their life savings to buy their first home. A week later, budget cuts claimed the job she loved. Last month, when their unemployment insurance was cut off, she sat down and wrote me a letter, the kind I get every day. "We are the face of the unemployment crisis," she wrote. "I'm not dependent on the government. Our country depends on people like us who build careers, contribute to society, care about our neighbors. I'm confident that in time I will find a job, I will pay my taxes, and we will raise our children in their own home and the community we love. Please give us this chance." Congress, give these hardworking, responsible Americans that chance. Give them that chance. Give them the chance. They need our help right now, but more important, this country needs them in the game. That's why I've been asking CEOs to give more long-term unemployed workers a fair shot at new jobs, a new chance to support their families. And in fact, this week, many will come to the White House to make that commitment real. Tonight, I ask every business leader in America to join us and do the same, because we are stronger when America fields a full team. Of course, it's not enough to train today's workforce. We also have to prepare tomorrow's workforce by guaranteeing every child access to a world-class education. Esteban Rodriguez couldn't speak a word of English when he moved to New York City at age 9. But last month, thanks to the support of great teachers and an innovative tutoring program, he led a march of his classmates through a crowd of cheering parents and neighbors from their high school to the post office where they mailed off their college applications. And this son of a factory worker just found out he's going to college this fall. Five years ago, we set out to change the odds for all our kids. We worked with lenders to reform student loans, and today more young people are earning college degrees than ever before. Race to the Top, with the help of governors from both parties, has helped states raise expectations and performance. Teachers and principals in schools from Tennessee to Washington, D.C. are making big strides in preparing students with the skills for the new economy. Problem solving, critical thinking, science, technology, engineering, math. Now, some of this change is hard. It requires everything from more challenging curriculums and more demanding parents to better support for teachers and new ways to measure how well our kids think, not how well they can fill in a bubble on a test. But it is worth it, and it is working. The problem is we're still not reaching enough kids, and we're not reaching them in time, and that has to change. Research shows that one of the best investments we can make in a child's life is high-quality early education. Last year, I asked this Congress to help states make high-quality pre-K available to every 4-year-old. And as a parent, as well as a president, I repeat that request tonight. But in the meantime, 30 states have raised pre-K funding on their own. They know we can't wait. So just as we worked with states to reform our schools, this year we'll invest in new partnerships with states and communities across the country in a race to the top for our youngest children. And as Congress decides what it's going to do, I'm going to pull together a coalition of elected officials, business leaders, and philanthropists willing to help more kids access the high-quality pre-K that they need. It is right for America. We need to get this done. Last year, I also pledged to connect 99% of our students to high-speed broadband over the next 4 years. Tonight, I can announce that with the support of the FCC and companies like Apple, Microsoft, Sprint, and Verizon, we've got a down payment to start connecting more than 15,000 schools and 20 million students over the next 2 years without adding a dime to the deficit. We're working to redesign high schools and partner them with colleges and employers that offer the real-world education and hands-on training that can lead directly to a job and career. We're shaking up our system of higher education to give parents more information and colleges more incentive to offer better value so that no middle-class kid is priced out of a college education. We're offering millions the opportunity to cap their monthly student loan payments to 10% of their income. And I want to work with Congress to see how we can help even more Americans who feel trapped by student loan debt. And I'm reaching out to some of America's leading foundations and corporations on a new initiative to help more young men of color facing especially tough odds to stay on track and reach their full potential. The bottom line is, Michelle and I want every child to have the same chance this country gave us. But we know our opportunity agenda won't be complete. And too many young people entering the workforce today will see the American dream as an empty promise, unless we also do more to make sure our economy honors the dignity of work and hard work pays off for every single American. You know, today, women make up about half our workforce, but they still make 77 cents for every dollar a man earns. That is wrong. And in 2014, it's an embarrassment. Women deserve equal pay for equal work. She deserves to have a baby without sacrificing her job. A mother deserves a day off to care for a sick child or a sick parent without running into hardship. And you know what? A father does too. It is time to do away with workplace policies that belong in a Mad Men episode. This year, let's all come together, Congress, the White House, businesses from Wall Street to Main Street, to give every woman the opportunity she deserves, because I believe when women succeed, America succeeds. Now, women hold a majority of lower wage jobs, but they're not the only ones stifled by stagnant wages. Americans understand that some people will earn more money than others, and we don't resent those who, by virtue of their efforts, achieve incredible success. That's what America's all about. But Americans overwhelmingly agree that no one who works full-time should ever have to raise a family in poverty. In the years since I asked this Congress to raise the minimum wage, five states have passed laws to raise theirs. Many businesses have done it on their own. Nick Shute is here today with his boss, John Serrano. John's an owner of Punch Pizza in Minneapolis. And Nick helps make the dough. Only now he makes more of it. John just gave his employees a raise to $10 an hour, and that's a decision that has eased their financial stress and boosted their morale. Tonight, I ask more of America's business leaders to follow John's lead. Do what you can to raise your employees' wages. It's good for the economy. It's good for America. To every mayor, governor, state legislator in America, I say, you don't have to wait for Congress to act. Americans will support you if you take this on. And as a chief executive, I intend to lead by example. Profitable corporations like Costco see higher wages as the smart way to boost productivity and reduce turnover. We should too. In the coming weeks, I will issue an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their federally funded employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour, because if you cook our troops' meals or wash their dishes, you should not have to live in poverty. Of course, to reach millions more, Congress does need to get on board. Today, the federal minimum wage is worth about 20% less than it was when Ronald Reagan first stood here. And Tom Harkin and George Miller have a bill to fix that by lifting the minimum wage to $10.10. It's easy to remember, 10-10. This will help families. It'll give businesses customers with more money to spend. It does not involve any new bureaucratic program. So join the rest of the country. Say yes. Give America a raise. Give them a raise. There are other steps we can take to help families make ends meet. And few are more effective at reducing inequality and helping families pull themselves up through hard work than the earned income tax credit. Right now, it helps about half of all parents at some point. Think about that. It helps about half of all parents in America at some point in their lives. But I agree with Republicans like Senator Rubio that it doesn't do enough for single workers who don't have kids. So let's work together to strengthen the credit, reward work, help more Americans get ahead. Let's do more to help Americans save for retirement. Today, most workers don't have a pension. A Social Security check often isn't enough on its own. And while the stock market has doubled over the last 5 years, that doesn't help folks who don't have 401ks. That's why tomorrow I will direct the Treasury to create a new way for working Americans to start their own retirement savings. My IRA. It's a new savings bond that encourages folks to build a nest egg. MyRA guarantees a decent return with no risk of losing what you put in. And if this Congress wants to help, work with me to fix an upside-down tax code that gives big tax breaks to help the wealthy save, but does little or nothing for middle-class Americans. Offer every American access to an automatic IRA on the job so they can save at work just like everybody in this chamber can. And since the most important investment many families make is their home, send me legislation that protects taxpayers from footing the bill for a housing crisis ever again and keeps the dream of home ownership alive for future generations. One last point on financial security. For decades, few things exposed hardworking families to economic hardship more than a broken healthcare system. And in case you haven't heard, we're in the process of fixing that. A pre-existing condition used to mean that someone like Amanda Shelley, a physician's assistant and single mom from Arizona, couldn't get health insurance. But on January 1st, she got covered. On January 3rd, she felt a sharp pain. On January 6th, she had emergency surgery. Just 1 week earlier, Amanda said, and that surgery would have meant bankruptcy. That's what health insurance reform is all about. The peace of mind that if misfortune strikes, you don't have to lose everything. Already, because of the Affordable Care Act, more than 3 million Americans under age 26 have gained coverage under their parents' plan. More than 9 million Americans have signed up for private health insurance or Medicaid coverage. 9 million. And here's another number, zero. Because of this law, no American, none, zero, can ever again be dropped or denied coverage for a pre-existing condition like asthma or back pain or cancer. No woman can ever be charged more just because she's a woman. And we did all this while adding years to Medicare's finances, keeping Medicare premiums flat, and lowering prescription costs for millions of seniors. Now, I do not expect to convince my Republican friends on the merits of this law. But I know that the American people are not interested in refighting old battles. So, again, if you have specific plans to cut costs, cover more people, increase choice, tell America what you'd do differently. Let's see if the numbers add up. But let's not have another 40-something votes to repeal a law that's already helping millions of Americans like Amanda. First 40 were plenty. We all owe it to the American people to say what we're for, not just what we're against. And if you want to know the real impact this law is having, just talk to Governor Steve Beshear of Kentucky, who's here tonight. Now, Kentucky is not the most liberal part of the country. That's not where I got my highest vote totals. But he's like a man possessed when it comes to covering his Commonwealth's families. They're our neighbors and our friends, he said. They're people we shop and go to church with. Farmers out on the tractor. Grocery clerks. They're people who go to work every morning praying they don't get sick. No one deserves to live that way. Steve's right. That's why tonight I ask every American who knows someone without health insurance to help them get covered by March 31st. Help them get covered. Moms, get on your kids to sign up. Kids, call your mom and walk her through the application. They'll give her some peace of mind, and plus she'll appreciate hearing from you. After all, that's the spirit that has always moved this nation forward. It's the spirit of citizenship, the recognition that through hard work and responsibility, we can pursue our individual dreams but still come together as one American family to make sure the next generation can pursue its dreams as well. Citizenship means standing up for everyone's right to vote. Last year, part of the Voting Rights Act was weakened, but conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats are working together to strengthen it. And the bipartisan commission I appointed, chaired by my campaign lawyer and Governor Romney's campaign lawyer, came together and have offered reforms so that no one has to wait more than a half hour to vote. Let's support these efforts. It should be the power of our vote, not the size of our bank accounts, that drives our democracy. Citizenship means standing up for the lives that gun violence steals from us each day. I've seen the courage of parents, students, pastors, police officers all over this country who say, "We are not afraid." And I intend to keep trying, with or without Congress, to help stop more tragedies from visiting innocent Americans in our movie theaters and our shopping malls or schools like Sandy Hook.